Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Glad to have you listening in this morning, this afternoon on today's Connecting Faith. Ted, you know the famous seven last words of the church?
The seven last words of Christ, but seven last words of the church are,
we've never done it this way before,
I think.
So.
Seems about right.
So we're going to talk today about someone who wasn't satisfied with that phrase. In fact, has made a point of, I don't know if... We'll have to find out if he was trouble in school or if he just likes the idea of disruption. Actually, my guest today has written a book called Disruption, Repurposing the Church to Redeem the Community. And we're looking forward to find out more about that in the moments ahead and do some copies of this great book to give away. And so I want to encourage you to sign up for that. As every time we have resources available, we always pass them on via drawing. We do that at the top of the hour. So I think we'll just jump right in and get to the conversation because we got a lot to get to. Mark DeMaz is founding pastor and directional leader of the Mosaic Church of Central Arkansas. And it's a multi-ethnic and economically diverse church with men and women from more than 30 nations. In fact, Mark and his wife Linda chose to plant a church in the heart of the University District of Little Rock. It's an area of high crime, poverty, and homelessness. They began serving the homeless, poor, and struggling immigrants and started a nonprofit to help teens and foster teens. And the story goes on. We're going to find out more about it. Mark is a recognized leader in the multi-ethnic church movement. He's written several books, including Building a Healthy Multi-Ethnic Church and Multi-Ethnic Conversations, an 8-week guide to unity in your church, which we want to find out more about in the moments ahead as well. But Mark, we want to just get started on today's conversation. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with y'all. Thanks so much for having me.
We were just chatting before the show, and of course, you know, me being the host, I should know actually what our Twitter handle is, but it's at ConnectFaithFR or, you know, at My Faith Radio. So anyway, we're a little shop talk there. So, Mark, the book is based on, the word disruptor, or let's talk about what that is and, you know, should it apply to the church?
Yeah, well, I appreciate, again, you all having me on your show. Appreciate your show, the great work of family, Faith Radio there and what you're doing. I was speaking a year and a half ago or so in January for the Evangelical Covenant Church, their national gatherings. And I came across, in preparation for that, an article written by a CNN contributor, a specialist in human behavior, but it talked about the concept of disruption in the business world. And this is a term that goes back to the 1996, to the late 90s, 1996, Clayton Christensen at Harvard. And he coined this phrase and applied it to the business world. Now, of course, I don't want to get in too deep on this, but the bottom line is that disruptors are people who see around the curve. They don't just leverage other people's platforms. They create their own platforms, and essentially they create new ways of thinking and doing things, and then hand us the new rules for how things work. And so they talked about disruptive leaders in disruptive companies like Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. You know, prior to Facebook, which really is only 10, 12 years old or so, the internet was really an exchange of information. Mark Zuckerberg disrupted that, created new rules, saw around the curve what's not only ahead but what's coming, got in front of it, and essentially created social media. Uber's done the same thing with taxi services. Amazon, it used to be that, you know, we were fearful of anything associated with giving a credit card online or shopping. Today, you go to a store to touch and feel the goods, and then you go home and order it on Amazon or online. So this was all disrupted the way we think, the way we do things. And so disruptive individuals become disruptive leaders of disruptive companies, again, changing the game, accelerating progress, in these different ways. Of course, they're not appreciated by the established quo, by the status quo and the establishment, and that's another part of the discussion. But at the end of the day, here's what I realized. We have a disruptive God. Think about it. God disrupted darkness and gave us light. He disrupted sin, gave us salvation. Disrupted time, gave us eternity. And as I read that article, as I resonated and did more research in terms of the business concept, I recognized that to repurpose the church, to redeem the community and an increasingly diverse society, it was long past time for disruption, creating new ways of thinking, doing things, and then handing people the new rules for how things work. This is what must happen to advance a credible gospel in an increasingly diverse society. If we have a disruptive God, and we do, surely he expects the bride on earth, the local church, to be disruptive as well.
I think sometimes maybe people hear that about repurposing the church, and they say, well, does that mean that we adjust to the culture? So isn't that sort of accommodation? Isn't that one of the big tension points among the believers today? How do we live within the culture but still stay separate from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been reflecting on that for 30 years since a seminary or so. And of course, another way to state that question is that the church should not be informed by culture. Rather, we should be informing culture, right? And you've heard it said that way, et cetera. And this is certainly true. What I propose in my book, and it's not just a proposal, we've been doing this for 16 years in our community. I have other churches that I've referenced in the book, point to three specifically around the country, that are actually influencing the culture by being disruptive. And we can talk about that in a second. But the other thing about that, though, Neil, and this is where we as evangelicals and particularly conservatives, we can often be disingenuous about how we understand culture, because the Word of God, the Bible, yes, it's timeless, but it's also informed by the culture of the times. The men of Issachar understood the times. For instance, today women wear jewelry. In Paul's day, he said, don't do it. So we throw that out. We say, well, that was cultural then. It's not a big deal today if a woman wears earrings or what have you. And so we are making cultural judgments at different points where the Word of God. And I think we're disingenuous sometimes when we think about that. Having said that, again, that's another discussion. I think that what you're referring to really is what I'm referring to. No, we should not be informed by culture. What we want to do is disrupt culture, beginning with the church. If we disrupt the church culture, the way we think, see, do, and practice church in the 21st century, trust me, it will disrupt the way the society, the culture sees the church, and we will become influential, because today we have zero credibility on the single greatest issue of our times, which is all things racial. We're not in the game. We're not taken serious. And in fact, we're having increasing restrictions slapped on us because we are not engaged with culture in a meaningful way, in a way that they appreciate. That's what my book is all about, and can help churches get to the front of the line and get back in a position of leadership and influence in an increasingly diverse society that is also very cynical and skeptical to the gospel and the church.
You talk about it's a new reality that we need to adjust to, and you just sort of touched on it, but certainly race is one of those. But maybe talk about what are those critical adjustment areas. Let's set those up where we can dive in deeper after the break.
Yeah, you bet. Well, in the book, of course, there's many points, but I'll just give you two streams of thought, and then we can talk, like you said, after the break. First of all, the one is to think about the church doing business, so to speak, as a three-legged stool. Predominantly in the conservative evangelical churches, of which I've been a part all my life since getting into ministry and in that world, we typically think about spiritual things. So think about that as one leg of a three-legged stool. And we measure success by numbers, dollars, buildings, how many people got saved, how many people get baptized, discipleship, small groups. But everything, by and large, is measured in a spiritual way. But the conservative evangelical side typically dismisses or does not engage in what others would call social justice or biblical justice. In fact, we set that up as polar opposites of the gospel, and we're oftentimes very fearful of that. Think of justice and the work of justice as a second leg of a stool. And then the third leg of the stool is for-profit income. Now, this is very important to think about, because when the government takes away tax-exempt status for local churches, and I believe in our lifetime that will happen. In fact, that can happen as fast as it takes to swear in a president, have them march down Pennsylvania Avenue, go into the Oval Office, and sign an executive order. That will, talk about disruption, that will completely disrupt the church. Tens of thousands of churches will go out of business overnight, and potentially hundreds of thousands of jobs will be lost when tax-exempt status is no longer available to the church. In other words, we are not positioned for that. And by leveraging church assets and brain power to advance for-profit income that not only helps fund mission, but blesses a community by creating jobs, lowering crime, repurposing abandoned property, this is smart economics the church doesn't practice, and that's one strain of thought that we deal with in disruption. We can no longer play only in a spiritual sandbox. We've got to be engaged in justice and economics in a three-legged stool through the local church and aggregate these three things, and that's what gives us a credible message in an increasingly diverse society.
I hope as you've listened, you've kind of got your appetite whetted to find out more. We've got some copies of Mark DeMaz's book to give away, and we're going to have a great discussion in the moments ahead. I want you to stick around for that. Mark is a directional leader of the Mosaic Church of Central Arkansas, and he's president of Mosaic's Global Network and the convener of the Triennial National Multi-Ethnic Church Conference. He's also an adjunct professor at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary and teaches doctor ministry courses across America. And he and his wife reside in Little Rock, where they started a church, and he's going to tell more of his story in the moments ahead. Do want to just encourage you to join in and sign up for a copy of the book, Disruption. You can sign up at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question or a comment, you want to join in the discussion, we're always welcome you to do so. You give us a call, 877-933-2484. More with Mark DeMaz as we talk disruption, repurposing the church to redeem the community, just ahead. That's what Jesus calls us to do, right? And yet we sort of hesitate, don't we? We prefer the familiar patterns, the comfortable ruts. Mark DeMaz is not one of those guys, although I'm sure he likes, comfort and patterns as well. But he and his wife, Linda, just felt called to plant a church in an urban district in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he has written several books and has become a leader in the area of a multi-ethnic church. And directs, in fact, he's co-founder of the Mosaics Global Network with Dr. George Yancey. The book we're referencing is called Disruption, Repurposing the Church to Redeem the Community. Mark is founding and directional leader of Mosaic Church in Central Arkansas. Mark, tell us a bit about your story. You and your wife basically decided you're going to not just do church as it was. I mean, you spent some time right doing youth ministry and working at suburban churches, so you know how it can be done.
Yeah, that's right, Neil. I for 18 years prior to starting Mosaic Church in Little Rock in 2001, I was a student ministries pastor, as you referenced. In the final eight of those years, I was in a large mega suburban church in West Little Rock. I had a youth group at the time after 8 years of 600 kids, built a $3.5 million student center, had 9 full-time people on my staff just for 7th through 12th graders. So I know that world. It was a great experience. I wouldn't be who I am today without those years. I was a raging river coming into that after 10 years of experience. That church put a dam on my life, and it was wonderful. Having said that, I looked around that church one day, this otherwise amazing church, that was both locally and nationally recognized, but pretty much in the Christian world, not necessarily outside of it. In fact, it was very much disliked by the liberals, by the progressives in the city, but very strong conservative church, et cetera. All that's to say is this. I looked around that building one day of 5,000 white Republican suburbanites, et cetera, and I realized the only minorities in this church were janitors. And that in a town of 40%+ African-Americans at the time, now, of course, a large Hispanic population. And that began to bother my spirit. And I began to ask in the late 90s this of myself. If the kingdom, if Christ taught us to pray, and he did, the Our Father, hallowed be thy name, the kingdom come, thy will be done where? On earth as it is in heaven. And I began to ask myself the question, if the kingdom of heaven is not segregated, then why on earth is the church? And that took me into a deep dive. I have my doctorate's in exegesis. I did a deep dive into Scripture, in a sense, throughout the commentaries, all that I'd been taught, which was basically that there were Jewish churches and there were Gentile churches, did my own work, and came to realize, as now has been validated through my writing and theology and people look at it, that every church in the New Testament outside of Jerusalem was what we would call today a multi-ethnic church. These were Jews and Gentiles intentionally walking, working, and worshiping God together as one for the sake of the gospel. So this wasn't about political correctness. This wasn't just nice. It was necessary. It was not optional. It was biblical. Every church that Paul plants, grows, develops is what we would call today a multi-ethnic and economically diverse church, I would add. And as I realized this, it wasn't Jerusalem that's the greatest church in the New Testament. It's Antioch. It's everything a pastor wants it to be. It's multi-ethnic, missional, mega, multi-site. This is the model church, and this is the church that sent missionaries to the world willingly. In Jerusalem, God said, go. Essentially, they said no. Why? Because if 3,000 people joined your church tomorrow or my church, we would all be freaking out. We don't have nursery beds. We don't have parking spaces. And think about it. The American church chases explosive growth as a signature of its success. But what you learn by studying the Church of Jerusalem is that explosive growth, more often than not, leads to internal focus. At Antioch, it was very different. These were intentionally multi-ethnic people that preached to a multi-ethnic audience, grew a multi-ethnic church, and when it comes time to send missionaries to the world, they actually go. Peter, James, and John, they didn't go. They stayed. But Antioch sends its best, Paul, Barnabas. Antioch, first church to take up a collection for the poor, as documented in Acts chapter 11. And it's the place where believers were first called Christians, at Antioch, Acts 11:26. So all that's to say is that I began to realize that the nature, this is part of what it meant when Christ said, thy kingdom come. And when he said the kingdom of heaven is at hand, it's because we want to reflect the unity and diversity of God's love for all people in real and tangible ways on earth as it is in heaven. And this is what Christ prayed for in John 17, that we would be one so that the world would know God's love and believe. Once that got in my belly, Neil, and my understanding and the theology was set, I had to leave. I was compelled as Christ to go. I was compelled to go to Samaria. I was compelled to leave that church and seek to be a bridge in the city to bring ethnic, economic, diverse people together, again, to walk, work, and worship God together as one. I had no idea it was something God was doing worldwide or was about to do, but over 16 to 20 years now of experience, now we're in this sweet spot where the American church is waking up to the reality, to this need. It's no longer a matter of selling this vision. The receptivity is high. Practitioners are there. And it's just a thrill to be a part of this movement that God is doing now and disrupting the way we've thought about church. And that was fine for a season, but like the men of Issachar, we have to understand the times we are. We have to disrupt our times in order to reposition the church to be a credible and out front voice for the sake of the gospel in an ever-changing community.
Now, Mark, you mentioned you just being a bridge to the community, but I know you addressed the fact that, you know, maybe that's how you started, but realizing that bridge maybe isn't the right metaphor, because that sort of brings with it sort of a sense of, well, we'll you know, stay out in the suburbs, we'll run in for a little bit in the city, and we'll help you, and then we'll head back. That's not your approach, though, is it?
Not at all. In fact, that tells me you read my book, Neil, so I appreciate that. And I only use bridge because it's, I don't want to say dumbing down, but it's a quick metaphor. But
sure.
You're absolutely right. The bridge metaphor, it implies that we're on one side and somebody else is on the other, and we can go do some tutoring, we can send a check, but we get to come home at the end of the day and wash our hands. You're absolutely right. That's not the metaphor. I was no longer interested in building bridges to the community once this theology got in my belly. I wanted to be the community. And I mean the church that I was a part of. I wanted it to reflect the community, the beauty, the diversity of the community, and yet the unity of the gospel. And that's why we called it Mosaic. You know, Irwin McManus, my friend, was the first to use that name in 1996. We picked it up in 2001. But what a great picture, right? The unique pieces, sometimes sharp edges, all different sizes, shapes, colors, but the Holy Spirit brings us together, holds us together, as Paul talks about in Ephesians 4, to create one beautiful picture, a compelling witness, so that the manifold wisdom of God will be displayed to the world through the local church. And so that's why we picked this word mosaic. Another metaphor that's interesting, Sung Cha Ra, a friend of mine, talks about the salad bowl and how that, you know, there's lettuce and cucumber and tomato. And in terms of building healthy churches for the 21st century, in the past, it's some church, many, you know, churches might have had a measure of diversity. So they got lettuce, tomato, cucumber, blacks, whites, Hispanic in the pews. But then the American Evangelical Church has poured ranch sauce over the whole thing. And so when you put your fork in and taste the tomato, it tastes like ranch sauce, lettuce. The idea is get rid of the sauce. So as Paul prayed in Ephesians 3, we can know the height, the breadth, the length, the depth of God's love in and through the local church to, again, export a credible witness of God's love for all people in an increasingly diverse society. So, yes, the bridge metaphor is not the one. A salad bowl without the ranch sauce is another great one. Jazz theology, my good friend out in Denver, Colorado, wrote a book about that, how jazz and the nuances of that, where there's structure and yet freedom, there's unity yet diversity, a great metaphor as well. On that, as we talked about.
Mark, I'm interested, we're going to come, we got a couple minutes before we take a break, but say a bit about maybe what proved to be the biggest challenge in your church plant. And I don't know if you want to use the word church plant, but what were some of the early obstacles, and are they common obstacles that others would face as well?
Yeah, you bet. Real quick, I know you got a break coming up, but I actually wrote a 60,000-word book on those challenges called Leading a Healthy Multi-Ethnic Church. But we face personal, spiritual, relational, cultural challenges. They're all embedded, but very specifically, one was the challenge to overcome the mindset, and this again becomes disruptive thinking, in the American church that we are to target people groups in planning a church. So when you for all these years, literally since 1972, when church planners go out to plant a church or go to a denomination, say they want to plant a church, the first question they're asked is, who's your target audience? And that means coming up with something like, well, I'm targeting 20 to 30-year-old white young people living in the suburbs. That is not a biblical question. That is a biblical question in it so far as it applies to evangelism, discipleship, or leadership development. But once you cross the line to plant, grow, or develop a local church, you have no biblical license or freedom to plant, grow, or develop a church focused on a single people group. So for more than 50 years, this has been the standard in evangelicalism. So when I and others in early 2000 began to plant intentionally diverse churches, there was tremendous pushback as if it wasn't biblical theology. It would never work, mixing black, white, Hispanic, Asian, et cetera. Economic diversity, a big challenge as well, because if you create an ethnically diverse church, you're going to have economic diversity. The place that we planted in the urban center, of course everybody wants to plant in the suburbs. There's money, there's growth, but what about repurposing abandoned property in cities like Detroit or East LA or Little Rock, Arkansas, Birmingham, Jackson? Very few people have wanted to go there in the past. And so again, all of this went against conventional wisdom, but what you recognize in conventional wisdom, it's the status quo. And the status quo fights against disruption. And that's why disruptors take their ball, go home, and create new ways of doing things.
We're going to talk more about disruption, repurposing the church to redeem the community. Mark DeMaz is a challenging author, and he's a founding pastor and directional leader of Mosaic Church of Central Arkansas. We've got some copies to give away at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. What does it mean to be a compelling witness today, to truly represent Christ, be his bride, be the church? Mark DeMaz has been thinking through that, and he's been leading, been a thought leader in the whole area of what it means to be a multi-ethnic church. In fact, he's written several books about that, Building a Healthy Multi-Ethnic Church and Multi-Ethnic Conversations, an 8-week guide to unity in your church, which is a daily devotional, small group curriculum on the subject for people in the pews. The one we're referencing, his latest, is called Disruption, Repurposing the Church to Redeem the Community. He quotes Dave Gibbons, says that the people in a society that highly valued diversity will soon view a segregated church the way Christians have historically viewed cults. They won't get it, they won't like it, and they won't trust it, no matter how good its intentions. That's pretty sobering, Mark. Talk more about, you know, what it really looks like to establish and how you establish it in Mosaic, a multi-ethnic congregation that was not only multi-ethnic, but multi-resource as well.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. The multiple resources, it goes back to what we were talking about before the break, where, you know, traditionally, as it were, in terms of church planning, growth and development on the economic side, one of the telltale signs of maturity is a phrase called sustainability. In other words, is a church self-sustaining economically? And this is a mark that churches, like, they plant, they want to get sustainable by 3 years, et cetera. But all of that, the whole phrase of sustainability is related to tithes and offerings. So churches have measured their sustainability based on tithes and offerings. Do the tithes and offerings cover the budget? In creating healthy, multi-ethnic, economically diverse churches that are impacting, particularly in urban communities, resources are lacking. And when people join your church, in our situation for many years, it's like the more people that join your church, it actually costs you money. It doesn't make you money, so to speak, because tithes and offerings. It costs you money because of the economic condition of the environment, the neighborhood, the people that come, the people in need. And so all that led us over time to recognize that not only did we have to operate on spiritual, social, and financial fronts, that is, preaching the gospel, advancing justice in our community, and creating economic for-profit income that blesses the community through job creation, crime reduction, etc. But that, having said that, desperation led to innovation. And so what I'm saying is that we have, as a church now, multiple streams of incomes. Through our nonprofit, we get federal, local, state grants. We have we took over a former Kmart. We purchased a former Kmart, renovated, and then rented half the space in order to pay our mortgage and payments. So we're actually making money, but doing it at a reduced rate to small business, which allows them to create jobs, in this case 30 jobs, repurpose abandoned property, crime goes down, tax revenue goes up, and the city loves you. And this is what it means to get out front and disrupt things, because when you're only preaching redemption without actually bringing redemption to local communities in tangible ways through repurposing abandoned property, job creation, reduction in crime, this preaches redemption. In other words, we don't have to preach redemption. We are demonstrating redemption daily. So we preach the gospel, yes, on the spiritual side, but we have an umbrella nonprofit called Vine and Village, Christ is the Vine intersecting the village, with multiple programs that serve a specific community, and these programs are advancing the common good, and again, different economic resources whereby we're trying to generate for-profit income and position the church for disruption in the future related to the tax code, as well as aggregate our resources to advance the common good. And so all that's to say is that desperation led us to innovation in this way. We didn't have a grand plan. Our simple plan was to bring diverse people together to walk, work, and worship God together as one, as a credible witness of God's love for all people in our community. And one thing led to another, desperation to innovation, and that's how we became disruptive.
I noticed you had a quote from Tim Keller there, and he talked about, you know, that we need to use the church's resources to seek a flourishing city, as opposed to our kind of our mindset is usually the other way around, right? We'll just use the resources of the city to build a flourishing church.
Exactly. In fact, who set me on to this, and he didn't even know he was doing it, but my good friend Rick Warren, about 6-7 years ago, I went to an event when they were actually launching the peace plan at Saddleback with about 300 pastors, ministry leaders. That's where I met him for the first time. But on the stage that day, he said, "We can't keep begging people for money." And that really struck me at the moment in the life of my church, because I had already seen that that was true. When you don't have the economic resources in a church to go ask people for money, when you need money to help the people come to your church, how do you do it? And so this is what led us to create 6 or 7 different income streams. And we are sustainable, but 16 years later, only roughly 66% of our budget comes from tithes and offerings, and the other third of our budget comes through multiple streams of income. I don't think that's just an anomaly for my church or churches like mine. I do, in fact, believe the future of the American church will have to get to this space. And like Tim Keller said, when we think like this, it leads to flourishing in a particular community, which therefore allows us to to present a credible gospel witness in a way that can be heard by a progressive and liberal community that is not self-serving. And that's a really important point, Neil. It's not about leveraging church assets to build your own kingdom. It's about leveraging church assets to bless the community, lead people to Christ, and at the same time, help fund mission.
We use the word, kind of throw the word community around once in a while, but you've actually, you've taken a zip code and said, this is our zip code, right? I mean, you are embedded in the community.
Yeah, that's the incarnational approach, of course. And what I react to in the book is, in fact, I when I speak on this, I'll ask, you know, an audience of pastors, how many of you as pastors have ever said or heard it said, we're going to take this city for Christ, you know, we're going to change the world for the gospel, and they all raise their hand. Then I ask them, how many of you have seen that happen? And do you know what happens when I ask them that follow-up question? They all chuckle, literally. The entire room chuckles because they've virtually never seen it happen. And so what I talk about in the book is that's rhetoric. Why does our rhetoric, that is our communication, we're going to take this city for Christ, why does that rhetoric so often fail to produce real measurable results in this regard? I break it down in the book in three ways, but certainly one of them is that we speak in vague generalities. And this idea of a city, we're going to take a city or a community. Well, I hate to burst anybody's bubble, but no church is going to take a city for Christ. Only Christ can do that. Maybe a bunch of churches working together could do it, but what you can take is a five-block square radius. What you can take is an apartment complex. What you can take, perhaps, is a zip code, a very specific defined neighborhood that, given your church's context, your resources, your entrepreneurship, your vision, that you can make a spiritual, social, and financial impact in that space. That's like your Nehemiah. That's your section of the wall. And we need to get away from this vague generality that sounds good, you know, that we're going to change the city. But no, you're really not. But you can change a specific focus. And then when you aggregate your resources, particularly in terms of nonprofit work and justice, instead of sending money like a shotgun all over the city, a few dollars here, a few dollars there, some people over here, you focus all that resource on that particular target. It's not a target. It's not a people group you target. It's a section of the city, a community, a neighborhood, a zip code, if you were, whatever. Then you actually get synergistic impact because in a feeding program, for instance, we have a food distribution program in our church. We serve literally 19,500 people a year. It's 55% of the entire zip code depends on our church for free food every month. But we also have a chess club where their kids are in a chess club, and we're working with under-resourced kids. We have a Teen MOPS program. And the point is all those programs are focused in a 32,500-member zip code, and because of that, we know the people. We know their names. They know us. They don't see us as pastors of the church. They see us as pastors of the community. And that's what it means to be disruptive, to get ahead of the community, get ahead of culture, and be leading from the front and not screaming from the back.
Say a bit about the church as a peacemaker today. Obviously, we're dealing with a multi-ethnic church. There's racial divides are pretty deep. What does it mean to be a peacemaker? What does that require?
Well, of course, this goes back to Matthew 5:9 and Christ and all the Beatitudes. In every Beatitude, you get something for what you do except for one, which is peacemaking, and you're identified with someone. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. There is no closer that we can be identified to Christ in terms of mission and messaging and literally connected to the man, that is Christ, than when we follow in his footsteps as peacemaking, helping people make peace with God through faith in Jesus Christ, helping people make peace with one another across all the distinctions of this world that so often and otherwise divide, whether that's racial, economic, political, gender. This is what Christ talked about, love God, love your neighbor. It's essentially being peacemakers. But in our society today, the fact is Christians, in my opinion, are worse than the world. Remember when Donald Trump got elected president? If you saw that or watched on TV, after the parade, whatever, his speech, which, by the way, his speech ticks off everybody, conservatives, progressives alike, he gives his speech, goes in the Oval Office, and there at his desk, he's signing executive orders. Well, around the table is people like Mike Pence, there's the Republicans, Rance Priebus, but there's also Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, these hardcore, staunch Democrats diametrically opposed to Donald Trump. And they're all around the Oval Office, in the Oval Office there at his desk. And he's signing. They're laughing. They're trading pens. There's a congeniality there. But they're going to go out from that office and completely scream at each other on the media. And what I realized in that moment is that the world, and I know politicians. I have politicians in my church and U.S. senator in the past. I've been to Washington. I've been in the Senate dining room. These folks will fight it out in the media, et cetera. They'll argue their positions, stake their claims, even do ad hominem attacks at points. But then they'll go out for a drink. They'll go out and smoke a cigar. They'll trade pens in an office and laugh. You know what Christians do? We defriend each other. We defriend each other. And we are a very poor example of peacemaking, and yet we're supposed to be that for the world. So peacemaking involves getting a hold of your emotions, recognizing that no one is ever right in the extremes, and trying to bring balance to the conversation, measure our words without emotion, and learn to handle ourselves in a way that is compelling on social media. For instance, in social media, if people pay attention, people will spout their opinions, and they're often polarized to one position or another. And they get a bunch, and they do this because they appeal to their effective base. So, for instance, if I'm all about Hillary Clinton, let's say I'm a big Hillary Clinton supporter, and I'm tweeting all this bad stuff about Donald Trump, good stuff about Hillary, the likes, the retweets, the thumbs up, they're all from people who already agree with me, who already like Hillary Clinton. But all you're doing is pushing, by being so extreme, you're just pushing the people that don't believe like that further away. Shouldn't you want to win people who don't think like you to your argument? Shouldn't you want to win people who don't know Jesus to Christ? We have to measure our words, learn to be peacemakers in the marketplace, on the street, and in social media.
We're not talking about disruptive in terms of social media. We're talking about being disruptive when it comes to sharing faith, to advance spiritual, social, and financial transformation in your city. Find out what it means to be a disruptor. Disruption, repurposing the church to redeem the community. Mark DeMaz, director and lead of Mosaic Church of Central Arkansas, my guest today. Mark, thank you for taking some time with us today and for laying out a challenge. I look forward to hearing more about the work that you're doing and your thinking and writing. It's great to have you on with us.
Honor to be with you, Neil, anytime.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. We do have some copies of Disruption, the book to give away, and love to have you sign up for that. You can do it with a phone call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. We have a commission to go and to tell, and we're going to talk about those who have still not heard. The International Day of the Unreached is going to focus on the billions who have never heard the gospel, a reality, sadly, for over 2 billion. Wayne Peterson is Global Ambassador at Large for the mission organization Reach Beyond, and he is leading the way as chairman of the International Day for the Unreached, of course, longtime part of the Northwestern Media Network, and a good friend. Wayne, we love having you back with us today.
It's great to be here, Neil, and working with you again and being in this beautiful facilities that God has given us. Yeah. And, Neil, we go way, way back.
Yeah,
and I'm privileged to be interviewed by a guy that I said is probably one of the best interviewers in Christian radio, Neil Stavem.
Okay, well, now the pressure's on.
Yeah,
but we'll see where it goes. But, you know, for people that maybe just aren't familiar with the kind of mission radio impact that's going on globally, Reach Beyond was one of the pioneers of that. Give us a little summary. What was Reach Beyond all about?
Well, Reach Beyond, and most of our listeners would more apt to be recognizing HCJB, which was the pioneer station in Quito, Ecuador. And when Clarence Jones left Chicago, Clarence Jones was working for Paul Rader and received the call of the Lord to plant a radio station in South America. And there were only 6 radio receivers in all of Ecuador at the time.
Wow.
Not radio transmitters, receivers. And he had the vision to start a radio station there. It grew into shortwave that reached the four corners of the earth, literally with half-million-watt transmitters that reached into Africa and Europe, was very instrumental during the Cold War and the era of communism, reaching behind the Iron Curtain into Asia, China, Japan, that part of the world. And the focus has always been to reach those that have never heard. And even today, as we have sharpened the focus of Reach Beyond, our priority is to go to places where there are less than 2% Christian. So an example would be Thailand. We've planted about 42 radio stations in Thailand. Thailand is 0.5% Christian, heavily Buddhist, and working to plant indigenous stations staffed and programmed by nationals that know the language and know the culture. A satellite ministry that reaches into North Africa and the Gulf region in the Middle East, where a heavily, heavily Muslim area, and having 1.8 million people a week listening to our programming over satellite and internet. So these are the things that have been the focus of HCJB. Now we call ourselves Reach Beyond, reaching beyond where the gospel has ever gone before, to the people that God said were to reach the uttermost parts of the earth.
To that end, let's talk about the fact that that Great Commission has yet to be fulfilled, because there are still literally millions who have never heard. And it's probably hard for us to imagine that growing up in the Christian-influenced culture in North America.
Well, and it's billions, actually. Yeah. And it's probably 2 to 3 billion people around the world, roughly a third of the world's population, that have never heard the name of Jesus, except maybe in a cuss word. And these are the ones that God has a passion for the lost, for the unreached. Jesus had said that we're to go to the uttermost parts of the earth, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost parts. I used to hear you saying here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's what God has called us to do. Paul says, those that have never heard of me will hear. Those that were not seeking me will find me. And there are 2 billion people around the world that we need to be concerned about. Jesus' last words to his followers before he left the planet were to reach everywhere. And he says, I am with you always, even to the ends of the earth. Mm.
So coming up, you have set aside a special day. This is, I think, done with the last couple of years, or maybe just last year?
This is our
second year,
Neil. And we chose Pentecost Sunday. That was the day the gospel went out to every nation in the known world at that time, at Pentecost Sunday in Jerusalem, where people were gathered and they heard the language each in their own tongue. And so we know radio has the power to do that, to reach multi-ethnic, multi-language groups, and people can hear the gospel for the first time in their own language. So we've set aside Pentecost Sunday. This year it's June 4th, very late Easter and late Pentecost, to raise the awareness in the North American church about the call for the unreached and the Great Commission. And in some ways, our North American church has lost its vision and passion for the unreached around the world. And that's just a general sweeping statement, not universally true. But bottom line, our job is to raise the awareness of the cause for the unreached. So we're using churches and Christian radio like Faith Radio and Northwestern Radio and Moody and others to raise the awareness of the Christian public to pray for, to get engaged in, whatever way. Some can pray, some can pay, some can travel, and there are various ways to get involved in being sensitive to God's call to reach those that have never heard.
It's coming up, the International Day for the Unreached. It'll be Sunday, June 4th, as a day of emphasis, and hopefully many churches will join in and bring that as a part of their worship experience that day. But more than that, are there some things that we can maybe connect with online, or what do you recommend?
Absolutely. There's a website dedicated to this. It's dayfortheunreached.org, dayfortheunreached, one word, dayfortheunreached.org. And there's a 30-day Bible study and prayer guide there that people for 30 days can be instructed about the different unreached people groups around the world and to pray specifically for some of those people groups that are unreached. And it's a Bible study and prayer guide for 30 days. There are also, for pastors, there are sermon outlines, suggestions, there are stories. And I know that you'll be playing some of the spots on the air just to raise the awareness of the listeners to pray for this cause of global evangelization.
I remember seeing a report from, I think, the group Finish the Task, or maybe it was Paul Eshelman, I think, and some of the Jesus Film folks had actually sort of spelled out, here are people groups, distinct people groups that have no Christian witness. And it was sobering to actually look through that report and realize that, these are real people, these are real numbers that have no Christian witness. How do we increase our passion so that it's not just praying one day or 30 days, but make this a real passion of our hearts.
Well, I'm very thankful that Paul Eshelman has lent his support to this whole initiative. A number of us attended the Finishing the Task conference in California a couple months ago, and Paul Eshelman and Steve Douglas of Crew and Rick Warren have heartily endorsed the emphasis on reaching the lost. To me, Neil, it comes down, what's touched my heart is, I know it sounds overly simple, is just reading God's Word. And in the Old Testament, God's heart for the refugee, for the stranger, for the outsider. Jesus clearly had a heart for the outsider, that he went to the other side of the Jordan, the other side of the Galilee, purposely to reach those that the religious culture of the time had no time for. And even as you read through the book of Acts and Paul's letters, it's very clear. Paul's calling, Peter's call was to preach the gospel to the Jews. Paul's was to preach to the Gentiles. And he went into Asia, eventually into Europe, and his great passion was to preach the good news to the Greek and Roman world of the time. So for me, as I read through the book of Acts, that's probably the best devotional guide you can get for world evangelization, and see the passion and strategy to reach the lost. And I would just encourage your listeners to, as I've done numerous times in the last couple of years, read through the book of Acts. And you can't help but be touched by the power and the work of the Holy Spirit for those that have never heard.
And as I know, getting regular reports from Reach Beyond and other ministries, that God is at work and lives are being changed. I think that's probably that should excite us and fuel us to pray more.
Oh, my goodness. In the last 100 years, 100 years ago, 90% of believers lived in North America and Europe. It's almost entirely reversed today. Today, 75% of believers live outside of North America and Europe, in Africa, in Asia, in South America. The explosion of the church as the gospel has exploded south and east is just amazing. And we're seeing a double, sometimes triple digit growth of the church in some of those. Do you know the fastest growing church in the world is Iran? Percentage-wise, not numbers-wise, but when you have 400 believers and it grows to 800 believers, that's a 100% increase. Second fastest growing church in the world is Afghanistan. So in some of the most persecuted countries of the world, the most countries bereft of the gospel, we're seeing just an explosion of the gospel. And Christians there are being persecuted, but they are still boldly witnessing their faith in spite of the threats to their families, their lives, their health, their well-being. So it's an amazing day. The 21st century is very much like the first century as far as the growth of the church in unreached places of the world.
And it reminds us, hopefully, that we can be part of the advance team. Our prayer support, sending in, if you will, sort of air covers that God's Holy Spirit goes to prepare the ground.
Right? Yeah, and again, the book of Acts, the believers in Jerusalem, after investigating what was happening among the Gentiles, greatly supported the outreach of the gospel. And so we in the North American church have wonderful opportunities to pray and give and go and find ways that we can be involved in God's great commission.
Wayne Peterson, Global Ambassador-at-Large for the mission organization Reach Beyond, and he serves as chairman of the International Day for the Unreached. And that's coming up June 4, Pentecost Sunday. And they're asking churches throughout North America to teach and preach on the Great Commission and apply to the unreached, to engage in behalf of unreached people groups. And you can find out more, dayfortheunreached.org, dayfortheunreached.org. There's actually a Great Commission Action Guide, the website that you can download and become more involved. Near more than 2 billion people haven't had a chance to hear about Jesus, which is pretty sobering. It's time to get involved and pray, as prayer is the first thing we can do. International Day of Prayer for the Unreached. Find out more at dayfortheunreached.org. Thanks so much for listening to Connecting Faith today. If you missed part of our conversation with Wayne, or you want to hear more from Mark DeMoz, hear that interview again, we post all our conversations on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. So check it out there and join us tomorrow as we talk estate planning. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. Now, these conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.